Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into a really key Supreme Court case, Hess v. Pulaski. It's absolutely crucial for understanding how state courts can, well, exert power over people who aren't even physically there.
That's right. It's a 1927 case, but its impact is still very much felt today, especially when we talk about personal jurisdiction.
And the core puzzle, like you said, is how does that work? How can a state court pull someone in from another state, someone who wasn't served papers within that state? Hess gives us a big piece of the answer, specifically involving cars.
Exactly. We're looking at an accident in Massachusetts, but the driver being sued, Hess, was from Pennsylvania. So right away you see the issue.
Okay, so set the scene for us. Massachusetts resident Pulaski gets injured in Massachusetts. The other driver, Hess, lives in Pennsylvania. Standard stuff so far.
Seems like it. But the twist comes in how Pulaski actually sued Hess. Normally, you'd need to serve Hess with the lawsuit papers, personally, right? While he's physically in Massachusetts.
Which wasn't possible here, presumably, because Hess went back to Pennsylvania.
Correct. So Massachusetts had this interesting state law. It basically said, if you're an out-of-state resident and you drive on our roads, you're implicitly agreeing to let the state's registrar of motor vehicles be your agent.
Your agent? For what?
For receiving service of process. Meaning, if you get into an accident, the person suing you can serve the registrar in Massachusetts, and legally it counts as serving you, the out-of-state driver.
Whoa, hold on. So they serve a state official, not the actual defendant. That sounds like it could cause problems. Didn't Hess object to that?
Oh, absolutely. That was his whole argument. He said this violated his 14th Amendment due process rights. You know, being dragged into a Massachusetts court, potentially facing a judgment without being properly served in Massachusetts according to the traditional rules.
Makes sense. It feels like a workaround. What did the Massachusetts court say?
They actually upheld the law. They said it was a valid exercise of state power. So Hess lost there, and that's what pushed the case up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay, so the big question for the Supremes is, does this Massachusetts law, this substituted service on the registrar for out-of-state drivers, violate the due process clause? It's a real balancing act, isn't it? State power versus individual rights.
Precisely. And the Supreme Court, well, they came down on the side of the state, but with important conditions. They said, yes, a state can set up a system like this, where driving on its roads implies consent to jurisdiction for accident lawsuits.
Implied consent. Just by driving.
Just by driving there. But, and this is the crucial part, the state must also ensure there's a fair way to actually notify the out-of-state defendant about the lawsuit. You can't just serve the registrar and call it a day.
Okay, let's unpack that implied consent idea. It feels a little constructed, right? I mean, did Hess consciously think, yes, crossing the state line, I consent to be sued here?
Huh, probably not in those terms. The court wasn't saying he made an explicit agreement. It was more about the state's power to regulate activities within its borders, especially potentially dangerous ones. And Justice Butler's opinion famously called motor vehicles dangerous machines.
Ah, the dangerous instrumentality argument.
Yeah.
Because cars were newish and causing more accidents, especially across state lines.
Exactly. The court saw driving as a privilege offered by the state, not a right. And the state could attach conditions to that privilege, like consenting to jurisdiction for accidents you cause there. It was a way for Massachusetts to protect its own residents.
Okay, so the state has a strong interest in regulating its roads and providing a place for its residents to seek remedies if they're harmed by out-of-state drivers. That makes sense.
Right. It's a trade-off. You get to use our roads, but if you cause harm here, you have to answer for it here. But again, this only worked because the court looked closely at the process.
The due process safeguards. Hess's big complaint was lack of proper notice, right? So how did the Massachusetts law handle that?
This was key. The law didn't just stop at serving the registrar. It required the registrar to then do something very specific. Send a copy of the summons and complaint by registered mail to the non-resident defendant's actual address.
Registered mail. So there's proof of delivery, or at least attempted delivery.
Exactly. That registered mail requirement was the linchpin. The Supreme Court saw that as providing actual, meaningful notice to Hess. It wasn't just some legal fiction. It ensured he realistically would find out about the lawsuit and have a chance to show up and defend himself.
So without that registered mail step, the law probably would have been struck down.
Almost certainly. That's what made it fundamentally fair in the court's view. It satisfied the core requirement of due process, notice, and an opportunity to be heard.
Okay. And did it matter that this law applied to everyone, not just out-of-staters?
Yes, that was another important factor the court noted. The law didn't discriminate against non-residents. It applied to anyone using Massachusetts roads in this way. If it had targeted only people from other states, that could have raised other constitutional flags, like issues under the Privileges and Immunities Clause.
Gotcha. Now, how does this fit with the big case everyone learns first, Pennoyer v. Neff? That case was all about physical presence, wasn't it?
It was. Pennoyer really emphasized that state court power was tied strongly to territory. Generally, you had to serve someone within the state's borders for the court to have personal jurisdiction over them. Hess is a major shift, or at least an evolution, from that.
Oh, so?
Well, Hess recognized that with things like cars and increasing interstate activity, strictly sticking to the Pennoyer physical presence rule wasn't always practical or fair. It showed that certain actions within a state, like driving a dangerous machine on its highways, could create a connection, a basis for jurisdiction, even if you weren't physically served in the state at that exact moment.
So it's like the act of driving there created the jurisdictional hook.
Sort of, yes. It's an early form of recognizing that specific activities directed at a state could subject you to that state's power, foreshadowing later developments like the minimum contacts test from International Shoe. Hess cracked open the door that Pennoyer had seemingly kept tightly shut.
Interesting. So it wasn't overturning Pennoyer, but adapting its principles to a new reality.
You could put it that way. It showed that the principles of due process and state sovereignty could be met through means other than just physical presence and in-state service, if the right safeguards were in place.
Okay, so for law students listening, let's boil down the Hess test. Mm-hmm. What makes a state law allowing this kind of substituted service constitutional? What are the key takeaways?
All right, three main things to remember from Hess. One, the law can't discriminate against non-residents. Treat everyone using the road similarly.
Okay. No discrimination.
Two, there must be a provision for actual notice to the defendant. Something reliable, like the registered mail requirement here, to ensure they really know they're being sued.
Actual notice. Got it.
And three, the defendant needs a reasonable opportunity to actually show up and defend themselves. Enough time to respond, maybe ability to ask for continuances, you know, procedural fairness.
Right. Non-discrimination, actual notice, opportunity to defend.
Yeah.
Makes sense. And beyond the specifics, what's the lasting legacy of Hess? Why do we still talk about it?
Its legacy is huge, really. It fundamentally shifted the conversation about personal jurisdiction away from pure physical presence. It acknowledged that people could have significant connections with the state through their actions there, even if they lived elsewhere.
Kind of paving the way for how we think about jurisdiction over corporations, maybe.
Yeah.
And eventually, the internet.
Absolutely. It laid the groundwork for the idea that purposeful activities directed at a state could create jurisdiction. That concept evolved into the minimum contact standard in International Shoe, which is the bedrock of modern personal jurisdiction analysis. Hess also powerfully affirmed a state's right to regulate for public safety within its borders.
So it balanced the state's need to protect its people and roads with the out-of-stater's constitutional rights.
Perfectly put. It struck a balance that acknowledged the realities of interstate travel while upholding due process. It showed the law could adapt to new technologies and societal changes, like the rise of the automobile.
A really pivotal case then, even if it seemed straightforward initially.
Definitely. Its principles resonate far beyond just car accidents.
Which actually leads to a final thought to leave our listeners with. If driving into a state back in the 1920s could imply consent to jurisdiction, how about today? Think about all the ways we interact across state lines or even national borders online. Clicking agree on terms of service, buying something from an out-of-state website, posting on social media.
That's a fascinating question. Does clicking a button or visiting a website create the kind of contact or implied consent that Hess talked about? The principles of Hess state interest, fairness, notice they're all still intensely relevant in figuring out jurisdiction in the digital age. It's a whole new frontier.
Definitely something to think about. How these old cases continue to shape our very modern legal challenges.
Indeed. The core questions of fairness and state power remain constant.